The dangers of short-term steroids.
Ruling out a heart attack in somebody that has chest pain.
How often should we screen people with diabetes for retinopathy?
And does an antibiotic named azithromycin lead to heart arrhythmias?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on April 21st, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we're going to start with the oldest one first. On Friday, and we record on Thursdays, so this escaped our notice until the next day, in the British Medical Journal, a big study taking a look at folks who took short-term corticosteroids and a number of deleterious outcomes that seem to be associated.
This is an important issue because there's a substantial number of individuals that end up with short-term steroids. When I say short-term, that is less than a 30-day supply. We know that long-term use is associated with complications like high blood pressure and diabetes and the risk of fractures and infections, but nobody's really looked at whether short-term use is also associated with complications. So that's what these investigators undertook. They used a prospective cohort study looking at a nationwide database from private insurance claims. They looked at over 1.5 million adults, and of those, about 20% received at least one outpatient prescription for short-term use of oral steroids over about a three-year period. In those individuals who received them, they noticed that there was a marked increase in the risk of sepsis, about a five-fold increase in the risk of sepsis. That's a systemic infection. There was about a three-fold increase in the risk of having venous thromboembolism, that is a clot in the veins, and also about a two-fold increase in the risk of fracture. In the FDA warning, these are noted to be increased complications. So there are other complications they didn't even look at.
Also, let's talk about the age of these folks.
They looked at individuals under the age of 65, so it didn't even look at the older group. They even have a higher increased risk of complications. The other thing you might ask about is, well, why did they give steroids? They were usually relatively minor conditions, upper respiratory tract infections, low back pain, and kind of diffuse musculoskeletal aches. And you and I have talked before, is that there are alternative ways of treating these. Low back pain, physical therapy, even chiropractors we talked before, upper respiratory tract infections. If these are viral, they go away on their own anyway. So if 20% of Americans are getting steroids for relatively minor indications and they're associated with increased risk of complications, we need to reevaluate this.
Indeed, especially in the light of this evidence. And gosh, I would shudder to think about what happens in older folks with regard to this. Let's turn from here. Let's go north. Hey, Tom, we're going to reach out to you. We're going to take a look at a study from the Canadian Medical Association Journal. This was looking at azithromycin, an antibiotic, and ventricular arrhythmias, problems with the rhythm of the heartbeat.
Tom is a Canadian listener who's been with us for the 11 years we've been on and faithfully corresponds with us about how we're doing on social media. So reach out to Tom. This is a terrific study because there has been some concerns and some conflicting studies suggesting that azithromycin, or what's known as a Z-Pak, is associated with an increased risk of heart arrhythmias, and particularly those that are lethal, called ventricular arrhythmias. And that was based on observational studies that suggested that people that took azithromycin had a higher risk of sudden death, but also because a related antibiotic, erythromycin, is associated with an increased risk of arrhythmias. I think the important part of this study is how they sorted it out. They looked at seven population-based healthcare databases from 1997 to 2010. Big database, many different countries over a 13-year period, in which they looked at over 14 million new antibiotic users. And they compared their risk of having ventricular arrhythmias to those, A, that were not taking antibiotics, but here's the key, to those taking other antibiotics. So here's what they discovered. If you compare people taking azithromycin to those taking no antibiotics, it looked like there was a twofold increased risk of arrhythmias. Why were they taking these antibiotics? Usually for upper respiratory tract infections or urinary tract infection. But when they compared azithromycin to other antibiotic use, there was no increased risk. This suggests to us it has nothing to do with the antibiotic. It has to do with the underlying condition. So that's why I think this study is incredibly important, because it looked at a large number of patients, and I think it did the correct comparison.
And the take home with regard to you and clinical utility is
that if the patient needs azithromycin, if it's indicated, I wouldn't let the concern of arrhythmias dissuade you from using that for a different antibiotic.
Good news. Let's turn now, since we're talking about the heart, to something I think is really interesting. Gosh, somebody comes to the ED, looks like they're having a myocardial infarction or heart attack. What about assessing that?
When they say it looks like they're having a heart attack, if you look just across the general population and say for people that come to the emergency department complaining of chest pain that sounds like it could be a heart attack, what percentage actually have it? It's only 10 to 20%. Now, typically the way we evaluate that is we do an EKG, and if there are abnormalities that look like it's a heart attack, that can be very convincing. More specifically, we do serial blood tests over the course of 8 to 12 hours. Sometimes the person sits in the emergency room for that long. Sometimes they're admitted to the hospital overnight. Well, if you did that for everybody, we'd be admitting 80 to 90% of individuals that didn't need to have that type of observation because they didn't have a heart attack. So what these investigators did was said, can we do it by using a high sensitivity blood test, single measurement, in individuals that don't have any EKG findings suggestive of a heart attack? So they looked at 11 different studies conducted around the world of over 9,000 individuals, and about a third of them was considered to be at low risk. They had no EKG abnormalities and a single blood test that looked like it was negative, and they follow these individuals. And what they discovered is very few of them actually ended up with a heart attack, 0.5%. So the test was about 99% specific and about 99% sensitive for excluding heart attacks. They took it a step further and said, well, what about the false negatives where the test looked like there wasn't a heart attack, but there was? If the test was done within 3 hours of the onset of chest pain, it could be false negative. Once someone has insufficient blood flow to the heart, it takes 3 or more hours for this particular protein to leak from the heart into the blood to measure it. So if you measure it too early, there could be a false negative. So this single blood test with a normal EKG can help exclude heart attack in a large number of patients.
And you didn't name exactly what it is this blood test is looking for, so I think you should.
It's called a troponin measurement, specifically a troponin T. And that's the protein that's actually in the heart muscle that leaches out when there's insufficient blood supply.
Sounds to me like this is the strategy that ought to be immediately employed everywhere.
I think there's good justification as long as we don't do it too early. By the way, they not only looked at acute heart attacks, but they looked 30 days down the road to find out if these individuals died or not. And what they discovered was, again, it was about 99% sensitive and specific, even for predicting 30-day outcomes.
Good news. Finally, let us turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. People who have diabetes are at risk to develop eye problems, and they are screened routinely. Can we safely increase that screening interval?
The recommendation now is that people have annual eye exams. Because as you mentioned, diabetics develop something called proliferative retinopathy or macular edema, both of which put the person's vision at risk, hence the annual exams. Because if we detect it in its later stages, we actually have therapy that we can apply to decrease the risk of having vision loss. But there are different stages of this. People that have no retinopathy, people that have mild or moderate, or those that have severe. And there are people that have different control of their glucose, some that are well controlled and some that are not well controlled. If you use these two factors, can you predict who is likely to develop retinopathy, and on the basis of that, as you said, prolong the screening? Now, how would you do that study? Well, the easiest way would be to follow individuals for 30 years, take pictures of their eyes, and then you can determine how rapidly it progresses in these different patient populations. And that's exactly what this study did in over 1,000 patients. They had 30 years of follow-up with annual pictures. And what they discovered is those two things we mentioned, what stage do you start with, and what's your hemoglobin A1C, based upon that information, plug it into a computer, they can tell you when your exam ought to be. And if you have little to no retinopathy now and your sugar is well controlled, it suggests that you could increase that screening from once a year to once every 3 or 4 years. If you look at the population at large, we can decrease the annual eye exams by about 50%, and that'll save over $1 billion in healthcare costs.
Pretty impressive, and it can be done safely as well, with no risk really to the patient with regard to loss of eyesight.
Again, they model this based upon a 95% chance that the person wouldn't progress to a stage where they needed immediate treatment. Now, the flip side of this is if we decide to lengthen our screening, we got to be pretty vigilant about making sure that we keep a log, keep a record of when individuals need to be screened. Right now, you just make an appointment every year and it's easy. But if we make an appointment every 3 or 4 years, it's more difficult for the patients. We need to automate this and make sure that we don't notify the patient and say, come back in 4 years. It's we send them a reminder months before their next scheduled exam.
Excellent news. On that note, I'm going to talk about the short-term steroids this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.